The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
93 years old at the time of this recording, Catherine Hudgens has had what she considers a good life. But it certainly has not been without its trials and tribulations, its tragedies. At age 2 in 1930, Catherine contracted polio, and she remembers going through much of her early childhood in what she called little wheelchairs and little crutches. She was an active member of Kilgore, Texas's Girl Scout Troop No. 4 all the while. Around the time Pearl Harbor was bombed in 1941, she began undergoing several operations at Dallas's Scottish Rite Hospital, which was founded specifically to treat children with polio. Catherine overcame the damage the illness wreaked on her legs, though she would still undergo other procedures as an adult. In May of 1946, Catherine married Howard Hudgens, known to most by his middle name, Kenneth. Catherine and Kenneth Hudgens began a long union and started a family, welcoming into it several children. Both of Catherine's parents died at an early age, her father of tuberculosis at age 51, and her mother of cervical cancer just weeks before her 50th birthday. In the year 2000, Catherine and Kenneth's son, Howard Wayne Hudgens, died after what was said to be a courageous battle against cancer. He was only 52 years old. Catherine's beloved husband of almost 56 years, the man she described to us as her friend, husband, and banker when she went out gambling, passed away in 2002. The following year, in 2003, Catherine lost her daughter Jerry Ann, who was only 50. The deaths of those closest and dearest to Catherine, of course, were defining moments in her life. As she found the strength to overcome polio as a child, so too did she find the strength to move forward as her loved ones fell. But there was one tragedy in Catherine's life that, perhaps, defines her the most. This death has been impossible to move past, impossible to come to peace with, because there are no answers to soothe her grief, and certainly no justice. It's a tragedy she's had to fight to keep alive, and has been forced to investigate on her own for 40 years. In October of 1981, her 27-year-old son, Clarence Ray Hudgens, was ambushed and gunned down in cold blood outside his own home, in front of his wife and child. Clarence Ray Hudgens was born on June 22, 1954, to parents Catherine and Kenneth. Clarence most often went by his middle name, so we'll be referring to him as Ray going forward. The Hudgens family was a close-knit bunch as Ray grew up, alongside his sister, Jerry Ann, and three brothers, Kenneth, Robert, and Ricky. In old photographs of Ray, he's almost always sporting a large, unforced smile. One old school photo in particular, which looks to be about 7th or 8th grade, shows Ray in a black Oxford shirt, the collar unbuttoned on both sides and flipped up a little, his hair slicked back except a tuft that curls forward slightly, dangling over his forehead. His smile is seemingly unprovoked, natural. After high school, Ray spent a little time wondering what he was going to do with the rest of his life. And like a lot of young folks, he flailed some, but not a lot. Ray tied the knot at age 18 and had a boy, Michael Wayne, but the marriage lasted less than 2 years. Still, he knew he had to provide for his son, and Ray began to focus. He dove headfirst into the world of oil field work, a profession that, if an individual was determined, all but promised to be financially rewarding. Ray Hudgens also married again to a woman named Phyllis, and they welcomed a baby boy into their lives in 1977, his name Clarence Ray Hudgens Jr. After working for a few different folks, performing various duties in the oil field industry, a young, enterprising Ray Hudgens set out to start his own oil rig sandblasting and painting company. Though overnight success might not be the right way to describe Ray's foray into the world of oil, his company, Oilfield Blasting and Coating Incorporated, did well quickly. But with this line of work came a lot of competition, and though it's difficult for most of us to imagine, and almost impossible to describe without giving the subject its own episode entirely, some players in said competition were willing to commit egregious crimes to run others out and stay on top of the game. A newcomer like Clarence Ray Hudgens wasn't welcomed with open arms. Rather, he was welcomed with the promise of the violent destruction of his equipment. Ray's friend and competitor, R.L. Denman, of R&S Quality Painting Contractors Incorporated, like Ray, was well aware of the reality that their equipment could be destroyed at any time, and both men thought leasing land not only to store that equipment, but also to place trailer homes there so they could be their own night watchmen, was the only way to combat the sabotage. So, in 1979, Ray leased 2 acres in rural Gregg County, just outside of Kilgore, about 1.5 miles northeast of the intersection of Texas State Highways 135 and 31. He stored some of his equipment there, brought in a mobile home in which to live, and erected an office building about 10 to 12 feet from the trailer. When Ray had to be out and about on business, one of his 3 brothers, or parents, acted as watchmen, both day and night. So, in other words, someone was guarding the equipment and property 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This practice was quite common, in fact, especially in the East Texas, West Louisiana areas, to prevent both sabotage and theft, as a good night watchman was hard to find and likely costly. According to several handwritten or typed and signed letters found in the multiple boxes and briefcases provided to us by Ray's mother, Catherine Hudgens, Ray wasn't being overly cautious or paranoid. There were indeed folks out to destroy his equipment to get him out of the game for good. In either late February or early March of 1981, Ray got a call from a friend and Kilgore, Texas resident. This friend advised him that 2 men were on their way to Shreveport, Louisiana, in a red and white Ford LTD to, quote, blow up his equipment. Ray had an equipment yard near Shreveport on a property owned by his sister and her husband, Jerry Ann and Jackie Smith. The woman who lived on this property and kept watch of Ray's things called Jerry Ann and Jackie after Ray called her and told her that men were on their way there to bomb his stuff. Ray's sister and brother-in-law stayed there through the night, and luckily, nothing occurred. This is but one example of the threats to his property that the oilfield sandblasting businessman received. Someone, however, had far more than just threats in store for Clarence Ray Hudgens. Friday, October 16th, 1981, started off like any other day, with the exception of Ray's demeanor. According to his wife, Phyllis, that morning, Ray Hudgens went to work in his office next to their home, while she cared for 4-year-old Ray Jr. inside. At around 11 a.m., Ray Sr. left the office and walked to the mobile home to eat lunch. Once inside, he kept his head down, and Phyllis started messing with him to try and cheer him up.
"I'm not going to hit you, Ray," she joked.
But it didn't work. Something was weighing heavy on Ray's mind. He wouldn't even crack a smile at Phyllis's jokes, when any other day he'd play right along. Ray, in fact, wouldn't say much of anything. He ate lunch quickly and went back to the office. When he came back in the home later that afternoon, he was acting much the same way. Phyllis was worried about her husband, but figured it was just business that had him stressed out. She had no idea the terror that the upcoming night had in store. That evening, Ray's uncle Leroy and his aunt came over, along with a man we'll call Homer Edwards, his wife, and their adopted four-year-old, joining Ray, Phyllis, and their four-year-old boy, Ray Jr., for a fish fry. Ray Sr. lightened up as they entertained their guests. He and Uncle Leroy reminisced about old times with Homer, who had been involved with the Hudgens family for many years, once a business partner with Ray's dad. After they ate, Phyllis gave the boys some ice cream and sent them to the front porch to eat it so they wouldn't make a mess inside. But Ray soon reverted back to the troubled demeanor he'd displayed earlier in the day. About 5 or 10 minutes after Phyllis sent the boys out, Ray asked where they were. She told him, and Ray abruptly insisted that Phyllis bring them back in immediately, as he feared for the boys' safety.
"Have you lost your mind?"
Phyllis asked Ray. But sensing that the man felt something was wrong, she brought the children back inside. Sometime between 10:30 and 11 p.m., Ray and Phyllis's guests left, and she put Ray Jr. to bed. She and Ray retired to their bedroom for the night shortly thereafter. Sometime after they fell asleep, Phyllis doesn't know for sure how long, the cries of Ray Jr. woke her up. Phyllis went to the boy's room, and he told her he'd heard something loud and scary. She scooped him up and put him in bed with her and Ray. Everyone dozed back off, but Phyllis soon was awoken by something. Something frightening. It looked like someone was shining a spotlight in the back bedroom window of the home, the bedroom where the family was sleeping. Phyllis heard a boom followed by a crackling sound, as if there was an explosion that caused quick burning. She shook Ray, telling him to get up. She thought the house was on fire. At almost that exact moment, the doorbell of the home began ringing. That and the following took place in a matter of moments. At 1:17 a.m., now the early morning hours of Saturday, October 17, 1981, Ray called the Kilgore Fire Department as he put on his boots.
"My house is on fire. It's been bombed,"
Ray told the dispatcher at the firehouse.
"I need help now."
Phyllis began down the hall toward the ringing front doorbell. As she reached for the knob to open it, Ray, who'd followed close behind her, told his wife,
"Don't open the door."
So, instead, Phyllis ran quickly to the back bedroom and retrieved Ray Jr. The house was beginning to fill up with smoke. Ray Sr. grabbed his pistol and flipped on the front porch light, and with Phyllis and Ray Jr. behind him, he opened the door and guided them out. Smoke was filling the air outside, too. And as Ray led his family outside to the end of the short porch just before the steps, gunfire erupted. Phyllis had her finger in the belt loop of her husband's pants and with her other hand was guiding Ray Jr., but she lost grip of Ray Sr. just after the shot. She felt the bullets whiz past her, and in an instinctual move, Phyllis had stepped back into the house with Ray Jr. She began screaming for Ray Sr. to get back in. The risk of the fire inside, it seemed in that fraction of a second, was far less dangerous than the gunfire outside. And Phyllis was right. In the confusion and the pain he was no doubt feeling, Ray stumbled down into the yard, perhaps in an attempt to seek out whoever shot him. As Phyllis was frantically yelling for her husband to step back, two more shots rang out. She ducked behind the living room couch just inside, forcing Ray Jr. down with her. Phyllis, at this point, did the only thing she could think to do and called Ray's mother, Catherine Hudgens, telling her to hurry to the house, that Ray had been shot. She quickly called the fire department back, alerting them, too, that her husband had been shot. The home, at this point, was completely filled with smoke. Phyllis opened a couple nearby windows in an attempt to clear some of it out, but it was no use, and likely only fed the flames. She had to get Ray Jr. out of there fast. Picking up the boy, she told him to bury his face in her chest so he wouldn't breathe too much of the smoke. Phyllis turned off the porch light and bolted out the door, moving along the home to the porch's side. Phyllis hurriedly placed Ray Jr. over a fence that separated the home from Ray's office and fell over it as she did. She led Ray Jr. to the office building, and not knowing if whoever fired upon Ray Sr. was going to come back after her and her son as well, they crawled under the office to hide. Shortly after doing so, she heard a vehicle start up in the distance and take off. The two hid there for what Phyllis says felt like an eternity, though she knows that it was only a few minutes. She saw two sets of headlights in the distance and heard the distinct crunching sound of the vehicle's tires moving over the dirt road as they drew nearer. Phyllis Hudgens didn't know it yet, but the first set of headlights she saw was a fire truck, which turned around not long after she noticed them coming toward her. The second set of lights, however, continued to Phyllis and Ray's house. The car parked out by Ray's office. It was Kenneth and Catherine Hudgens, Ray's folks. Phyllis and Ray Jr. came out from under the office. They all walked over to where the body of 27-year-old Clarence Ray Hudgens laid, between the porch of the mobile home and the fence. Phyllis told us that Catherine took Ray's pistol from his hand and fired it in the air twice. It was an attempt to alert the fire truck that had turned around moments before. It didn't work, but when the firefighters returned to the station, Kilgore policeman Jack Fry told the men where Ray's trailer and office was. By the time they arrived back at the scene with an ambulance, Gregg County Sheriff's deputies and officers from the Kilgore Police Department had already arrived. Kilgore Fire Department Chief Paul Duckworth later reported that the fire started under the trailer, but he and his men had extinguished the flames quickly upon arriving. As firefighters fought the blaze, Gregg County and Kilgore authorities found 27-year-old Clarence Ray Hudgens laying in the yard just off the porch. Nick Dennis, the Gregg County Justice of the Peace, pronounced Ray dead on the scene at 2:40 a.m. The apparent cause, shotgun wounds, though he commented that he wouldn't say anything official before an autopsy was performed. At 2 p.m. on Monday, October 20, 1981, services were held for Clarence Ray Hudgens at the Raider Funeral Home Chapel. He was buried at Lakeview Memorial Gardens in nearby Longview. The conclusions of the autopsy of Ray Hudgens wouldn't be available for a month after his death. Pathologist H.P. Clifton Jr. performed the procedure. Many shotgun pellets were removed and examined from Ray's body as it lay in the morgue at Good Shepherd Medical Center in Longview. One pellet caused his skull just beneath his right eye to shatter, the bone fragments of which hit the brain, causing what Dr. Clifton called minor brain damage. Other pellets were found in his right lower back below the belt line and his shoulder. These wounds were disturbing since Phyllis had been directly behind Ray when he was shot. It was incredible luck that the buckshot missed her, not to mention Ray Jr. Among many other wounds was the one which resulted in Ray Hudgens' death. This injury entered just below Ray's right nipple, its trajectory allowing it to pass through the ribs and then his lung, before striking his heart and passing completely through it. The official cause of death is listed on the death certificate as gunshot wound to the chest, and on the autopsy report as, quote, shotgun blasts. The ammunition used, according to Ray's then-wife Phyllis, was double-aught buckshot. From what I understand, it's the most common shotgun ammo for hunting deer and other large game. If the damage from the firebomb and subsequent blaze didn't destroy the trailer home, the barrage of shotgun blasts made up for it. Buckshot had ripped through the metal exterior near where Ray was gunned down in cold blood, turning the cabinets inside, Phyllis told us, to sawdust. For the next several days, stories in the local paper, the Kilgore News Herald, reported little more than that the investigation into the death of Clarence Ray Hudgens was ongoing. However, one report released on Monday, October 20th, in the paper of Kilgore's neighbor 25 miles to the west, the Tyler Morning Telegraph, said that a long-standing dispute between Ray and some other individuals might be the motive for his slaying. Problems Ray was having, the article goes on to say, with competitors in the oil rig sandblasting and coating business. This came directly from Kilgore Police Chief Johnny Bradley, who was a little more open with such things than the department he was assisting, the department who had jurisdiction, the Gregg County Sheriff's Office. Sheriff Weaver, in fact, refused to comment on the theory. Texas Ranger Glenn Elliott, considered a legend to some, was also assisting in the investigation. We'll get fully into Ranger Elliott and what he brought to this investigation in Part 2. Strangely, the Longview News Journal reported this very same day that an arrest was pending, which seems to suggest that the authorities were onto something. However, that report was misleading, as investigators hadn't even determined a solid motive at that point, something that eluded them for years to come. On Friday, November 3, 1981, nearly a week after Ray Hudgens was gunned down in cold blood on his own front porch, the newspapers reported that two men had submitted to and passed polygraph examinations concerning his murder. Lieutenant Larry Smith of the Gregg County Sheriff's Office said that while they had a few leads to chase, none of them were strong. The most interesting clues surrounding the ambush assassination of Ray can't be found in the initial newspaper reports, if any ever. The day before he was gunned down, Ray and Phyllis's porch dog and yard dog both went missing. These are dogs that always alerted the Hudgens of anything at all that was out of the ordinary outside. Later, Phyllis told us, Gregg County investigators found the buried bones of their cow dog, Bear, in the woods not far from their mobile home. Tire tracks were found nearby, and authorities took plaster cast impressions. Sonny, their other dog, wandered up shortly after police and fire arrived at the scene the night of Ray's murder. The canine was dazed. His foot had been shot completely off, Ray's wife Phyllis told us. Also on the scene that night, the cops made it perfectly clear that Phyllis would be one of the first to be investigated, along with any business partner Ray had. We'll get to the latter in due time, but first, Phyllis. The investigators wanted to know why two bullets were missing from Ray's pistol, found close to his body. Phyllis explained to authorities that her mother-in-law, Catherine Hudgens, had taken the gun from Ray's hand and fired twice at the sky to try and catch the attention of the fire truck that had turned around after they couldn't find the fire they'd been called out for. It didn't take long for investigators to rule out Phyllis. After all, why would she have risked her life, and especially the life of 4-year-old Ray Jr., by setting fire to the trailer and shooting Ray Sr.? It seemed even more a stretch to imagine she would hire someone to do it, something that was even more dangerous on many more levels. But Phyllis did give investigators a clue. She said that whoever killed Ray had been in the home before, because not even a week prior, Phyllis had moved her and Ray's bedroom from one side of the trailer to the other. The firebomb was ignited directly under the spot their bedroom used to be, she told investigators. There was, however, another possible explanation for the assassin choosing that area to start the fire. A butane tank was fairly close to the spot, and perhaps they hoped it would ignite quickly and cause a large explosion. In an attempt to learn more about the details of the firebombing shotgun murder from Phyllis, authorities brought in a Dallas investigator who specialized in hypnosis. About a week after the ambush assassination, at the Kilgore police station, Ray's sister Jerry Ann accompanied Phyllis for the hypnosis. As Phyllis described for the expert the events of that terrifying night, her recollection of Ray yelling at her not to answer the door particularly stuck out. Jerry Ann later told Phyllis that when she recalled Ray exclaiming, "Don't open the door," both her voice and mannerisms changed to sound and look eerily like her slain husband. But Phyllis hadn't seen anyone, so getting her to provide a description was impossible. Whoever gunned down Ray was performing their devilish work under the concealment of the pitch-black rural Gregg County sky and the billowing smoke from the trailer fire. After the session, Kilgore police investigators discussed something they'd found as they combed the area around Ray and Phyllis Hudgens' home. A single ski mask, Phyllis told us, was found somewhere on the scene. Interestingly, the eye holes had been sewn so that they were much smaller, and the mouth hole had been sewn entirely shut. Brown hairs, Phyllis says, were found inside the mask. Still, with clues and evidence lacking, detectives asked the recent widow if she knew of anyone who wanted her husband dead. Though Ray kept his work life out of the home, never speaking with Phyllis about the day-to-day goings-on, she was well aware of the dangers involved in the business. She knew that there were plenty of folks competing, and that they were willing to steal or sabotage equipment in order to get to the top. Perhaps they'd even commit murder. She told investigators about a man Ray worked for, and men who had stake in the business, but clarified that she had no idea if they were capable of killing her husband, or if they even had any great motivation to do so. The cops needed to cover all their bases, and began quizzing Phyllis about Ray's indiscretions. It's certainly a T to cross, of course, but it was a stretch. How the assassination of Ray Hudgens was carried out suggested something far more sinister than a crime of revenge or passion. Everything about the attack suggested meticulous planning and execution. They struck like a thief in the night, like a chicken shit, as Phyllis put it when we spoke. Lighting firebombs, likely under what they thought was Ray and Phyllis's bedroom, might have killed them. It's plausible that that was the intent, but there was certainly a contingency plan in place as well. The firebomb gave the perpetrator or perpetrators time to move back and get into place before it went off. A blaze, of course, would force Ray out of the mobile home if the explosion and fire didn't kill him, and provide the perfect opportunity to gun him down. Fritz Swanson Road, Phyllis told us, was nearby and easily accessed by the hop of a fence on the property where she and Ray lived, and Fritz Swanson is a straight shot to Interstate Highway 20 to the north and Texas State Highway 31 to the south. Besides Crime Stoppers spots in the Kilgore, Tyler, and Longview newspapers during the month of December in 1981, reports about the ambush murder of 27-year-old Ray Hudgens stopped for years. Gregg County and Kilgore authorities were quoted as saying they were stumped, and that's about it. But possible motives were out there, and Ray's mother, Catherine Hudgens, began a now 40-year quest to find answers, feeling that the cops were never going to solve it on their own. Interestingly, considering his past investigations on crime and corruption in the oil-filled industry, Texas Ranger Glenn Elliott came up with a suspect of his own that wasn't connected to that line of work in any way. But like many investigators in the state of Texas at the time, and across the country, really, Ranger Elliott had caught a kind of a fever. One that involved a well-known serial confessor, whose admissions continue to be debunked to this day. It was perhaps the most senseless and ridiculous case of trying to pin a crime on Henry Lee Lucas that someone in the Lone Star State had ever seen. That story, and some likely players, are coming up next time on Gone Cold. If you have any information about the assassination of Clarence Ray Hudgens Sr., please contact Gregg County Crime Stoppers at 903-236-7867. We'd like to thank Phyllis and Catherine for contributing to this episode. Without Catherine's own investigative files into her son's murder, and Phyllis's vivid recollection of the night Ray was killed, we'd only have an incomplete story to tell. Those files and accounts were used as the main sources for this episode, but some details were taken from the Kilgore News Herald, the Tyler Morning Telegraph, and the Longview News Journal. If you'd like to help find answers for the families of unsolved crime victims from all over, or help identify a Jane or John Doe, please visit DNASolves.com, where you can submit your DNA data from a consumer testing company, like Ancestry or 23andMe, to their database. If you have not tested with one such company, you can get a kit directly from them by going to connect.dnasolves.com. Your DNA data there is used only for law enforcement investigations. At DNASolves.com, too, you can donate to one of the crowdfunding cases to help identify an unknown decedent or help solve a cold case. We'll provide links in the show notes. You can find Gone Cold on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram by using @GoneColdPodcast. We're also now on YouTube, where we hope to bring y'all the podcast in a kind of a different way, coming fairly soon. So go to youtube.com/C/GoneColdPodcast and subscribe. We'd greatly appreciate it if you did. You can support Gone Cold at patreon.com/GoneColdPodcast. Donors at all levels there get the show ad-free, and for just $2.50 a month, you'll have access to episodes featuring stories of mostly solved Texas crimes and the bad actors who perpetrated them, such as the Riverside Village Massacre, Parts 1 and 2, and our episode Doped Up and Ready to Kill, among others. Thanks so much to everyone who supports us there. We could not do this without you, and we appreciate it beyond words. If you like what we're doing here, you can also support the show by leaving us a 5-star rating and short review on iTunes. Reviews on iTunes help make Gone Cold visible to more people, and the more folks who listen to these stories, the greater the likelihood someone will come forward with information. If you have not already, we would immensely appreciate your 5-star rating and review there. The Austin American Statesman, the Houston Chronicle, the Sikkim Gazette, the Texas State Historical Association, and HauntedMagnoliaHotel.com were used as sources for this episode. Thanks for listening, y'all.